Sarah from The Journey and welcome to The Weekly. Now, I don't know about you, but I never seem to have quite enough hours in the day to fit everything in, and I certainly don't seem to have enough hours in the day to read all the interesting things that are out there. We thought we probably weren't alone in this, so we created The Weekly, which is a condensed version of all the key things we've been looking at over the last week or so in an easy, digestible podcast form that you can listen to on the go. Now, you might be wondering, if you're new to us, what even is The Journey? Well, we are dedicated to bringing you the latest science and evidence-based research around everything to do with conception, pregnancy, and the early years of a little person's life. The reality is, the world looks very different from the one that existed even just 10, 15 years ago, but in many cases, the advice we're given hasn't changed. There's a lot of fake news out there as well, so we're dedicated to bringing you practical things you can do, most crucially, all backed by science. So, without further ado, what is on offer this week? Okay, so after a few expert specials, we've got a little bit of a backlog, and to try and keep in our 30-minute time zone, we're going to rattle through it pretty quickly. As always, just a reminder to go much more in depth, which we hope you want to, check out thejourney.com. But quick headlines and quick rattle through what we're going to be tackling today. Firstly, as you probably know, if you've been listening to us for a while, we're pretty obsessed with the science around the microbiome. Now, we really talk all about the microbiome being the gut, but actually, did you know that you have a microbiome downstairs as well? Also known as a reproductive microbiome. Now that is pretty interesting and is increasingly linked to many issues relating to implantation, even endometriosis, and even miscarriage and premature birth. So we're going to rattle through the latest science and also, most importantly, as always, what you can do about it. Next up, we're going to be looking at screens and screen time, obviously a very modern phenomenon that you just really can't avoid completely. It's one of those things as a parent that you just get really stressed out about, but actually the best way to think about it is not to exclude it completely, but think about positive ways how you can actually manage this. And we dig into our expert network and speak to top pediatrician Mona Amin and top psychotherapist Christoph Sarawine to really tease out some practical ways to manage this. Then again, staying on the brain, it's the top 15 ways that science suggests you can help neurodevelopment in your kids. And this goes all the way from conception right through to the early years. We know that neurodevelopmental issues are on the rise, so it's about taking action where we possibly can. And we look at the positive things you can do to help things along. Finally, another major modern thing is the keto diet. Totally carb-free. I myself fell foul of this. It's fine for certain people and certain times of your life, but when it comes to trying to get pregnant, there's a couple of things to know. So we'll be digging into all of this. So let's kick off. Okay, so what do you need to know about the reproductive microbiome? Now, as we mentioned, at The Journey, we are not shy about talking a lot about the new science emerging around the power of the gut microbiome, particularly for our purposes, so hormones, development of the brain and immune system of a small person. Now, one well-known bacteria, Lactobacillus, may, it seems, play another important role. Now, did you know that there is a reproductive tract microbiome? Turns out there is, and turns out just like the gut microbiome, it matters, particularly once again for our purposes, i.e. having healthy kids. In fact, the latest science is suggesting that getting that right, or certainly into the right balance, could be a positive step, particularly when it comes to miscarriage, endometriosis, and aiding implantation and a successful pregnancy. Now, this all sounds pretty incredible. As always, of course, there are many, many factors behind the things we mentioned, and this is just one, so it's always important to bear that in mind. But let's take a bit of a look into what the latest science is saying, and it's actually pretty cool. So, taking a step back, what is the microbiome? Simply put, it's a collection of bacteria, fungi, even viruses. Now, obviously, the more famous microbiome that we talk about a lot is the one within the gut. But as we said, there's one that's up and coming, and that's the reproductive microbiome. Now, we've long known that the vagina has its own collection of bacteria, but more recently, science has discovered that this goes all the way up towards the upper reproductive tract, so the uterus, endometrium. And in fact, the Human Microbiome Project, which is a big project that's been going on now for the last few years, has estimated that the female reproductive tract accounts for almost 10% of the total bacterial load of the body. So it's pretty substantial. And again, to give you an idea and put it a bit into context, there are approximately 1 billion bacteria per gram of vaginal fluid in a healthy vaginal microbiome. So it's quite a bit. Now, we're also realizing that when things go wrong, there may be a link to this microbiome, as well as others, being out of balance. Now, we're not just talking about when you have a major bacterial infection, which is obviously not ideal and clearly causes problems. But what this research is suggesting is that more subtle imbalances that perhaps you might not immediately notice could play a part in challenges that some couples face. So the question is, what is balance in the case of the reproductive microbiome? Turns out it's all about lactobacillus. So unlike the gut, where the science as it stands suggests that we want as much diversity as possible with no imbalances, it seems the reverse is actually true when it comes to the female microbiome, certainly in the reproductive tract. Now, just as a reminder, this science is all very new and it's developing fast. We do not know it all yet, but this is what we do know. So recent research out over the last couple of years has suggested that actually what you want when it comes to the reproductive microbiome is heavy, heavy dominance by lactobacillus. In fact, as much as over 90% of the bacteria being made up of lactobacillus. Now, this does depend on the time of your life. It also appears to be somewhat dependent on your ethnicity, but when it comes to reproductive age women, it's certainly the case that when it comes to having a healthy reproductive tract, dominance of lactobacillus is what you want. How does this work and why does this work? Well, in pretty simple terms, lactobacillus produces something you've probably heard of, lactic acid. Now, this reduces the pH to below 5. In a nutshell, makes things more acidic. Now, of course, the more acidic you are, the less it is that undesirable bacteria are going to be able to grow. And this appears to be favorable for things like implantation, for example. So what happens if we don't have enough lactobacillus? Now, there is some evidence linking a lack of endometrial lactobacillus to those who struggle to become pregnant. That is possibly around implantation failure or even relating to those who suffer from miscarriage. Now, one of the reasons, according to the latest research, is around inflammation. Chronic inflammation is something we talk a lot about, but it appears that lactobacillus plays a role in reducing inflammation and encouraging implantation. Once again, we know, and it's pretty obvious, if there's a major infection, this can cause all sorts of problems, but it does appear that it can be more subtle than this. So as a reminder, it's good to note this is a link at this stage rather than anything definitive, but it's always good to bear in mind. The other thing that is showing some links is a connection between endometriosis and the reproductive tract microbiome. Now, endometriosis is a tricky one. It often doesn't get diagnosed, and question marks really remain over what causes it. Now, from a conception perspective, it can potentially make implantation and a viable pregnancy more challenging. Now, the interesting part of this latest research is starting to suggest that people who suffer from endometriosis may have a different type of reproductive tract microbiota. Now, the theories are that this altered microbiome could be a reason behind the inflammation that often comes alongside endometriosis and may trigger some of the symptoms. Now, of course, once again, the science is new, it's still developing, but again, it may well be an additional piece in the puzzle. And crucially, it might be something you could do something about. Then, of course, miscarriage is another area. And of course, there are multiple potential reasons behind miscarriage. And this can be anything from chromosomal abnormality, which means a genetic issue with the egg or the sperm, to the immune system misfiring, to a serious bacterial infection. But again, research is linking one other potential reason to this dysbiosis, i.e. an imbalance in the reproductive tract microbiome. So, another bit of food for thought. So what does all of this mean? And most importantly, what can we do about it? First and foremost, without risk of being a bit of a broken record, it's important to remember that with all this research, including the research around the gut microbiome, it's still very much in its infancy. That being said, having a healthy reproductive tract is never going to be a bad thing. And this research seems to further emphasize that. So, how do you actually proactively make your reproductive tract a more lactobacillus-friendly environment? Now again, no clear-cut answers, but one study suggested that potentially using probiotics, very targeted probiotics, could have a benefit. Now we are increasingly realizing that many of the over-the-counter store-bought probiotics could be a bit of a waste of money, but some of the stuff we're reading is that these targeted probiotic use, i.e. specific strains for specific things, could actually be a lot more beneficial. So once again, in the case of the reproductive tract, it seems relatively clear that lactobacillus domination is ideal. And in fact, there are several oral and vaginal probiotics currently commercially available. So check out thejourney.com for some of the ones that our resident expert recommends. And in fact, the initial results are encouraging. Now, what about if there's bad bacteria present? What about antibiotics? Now, obviously, this is only ever a conversation to have with your doctor. And frankly, before you start thinking about any kind of action yourself, if you think you may have a problem with implantation, with miscarriage, with endometriosis, you absolutely have to talk to your doctor. But feel free to have this conversation as well. It's always worth getting checked out before you do anything. But there has been some evidence that's shown if there is bad bacteria present or a particularly extreme imbalance, treating with antibiotics and then a targeted probiotic, so again with lactobacillus, can have some positive impacts. Now, once again, there are no silver bullets, sadly, with any of these things. The human body is complex, but if we do what we can do to get the body into balance and allow it to do its job, then that can be no bad thing. So this is certainly a bit more food for thought. Once again, check out thejourney.com if you want any more on this. Okay, so next up is all about the modern phenomenon of screens. I mean, I know I can't escape my iPad, my phone, and for sure my son sees me doing this and is really interested in both of these things. Now, unfortunately, we know that these are not going away, and actually they can be really helpful. So it's all about how to manage this in a positive way. Now, we are very proud of our expert advisory board here at The Journey, and we have used two of our resident experts, Dr. Mona Ammon, who's a well-known US pediatrician, as well as Christoph Sauerwein, who is a psychotherapist and specialist in childhood-based disorders, really pick their brains about the practical things that you can do. So, we know that things like ADHD is on the rise in kids, and we also know that screen time is massively on the rise, and that's for all of us. Question is there a connection, and how as parents do we realistically manage this new paradigm? Now, we are not a parenting resource. We believe parenting styles are really up to the individual. There's lots of opinions, and frankly, there's lots of debate, but we are all about how parents can influence the health of their little people. And obviously this is where screen time comes in. Now, taking a step back, it's worth understanding how screen time can impact a child's developing brain. Once we understand this, we can potentially try and manage it in a healthy and positive way. Now, Christoph's view is that ADHD is on the rise. Now, that's both a combination of more diagnosis and just more of it happening. He points to the fact that around 10 to 15% of children are now being impacted. And he also notes, like with many other things, that there are many, many causes. However, misuse of screens can absolutely be a contributing factor. So the big question is, what actually is misuse? Now for him, it's simply a case of too much too early. Now to give you an idea, maybe this is a little bit more of an extreme, but recent research showed that nearly 50% of children with ADHD reported 2 hours or more of screen time on an average school day. Now, clearly that's quite a lot. The issue, Christoph says, is that screens in excess can cause something that's known as hyperarousal. Now, what on earth is that? In a nutshell, one of the ways that screens impact children is the fact that fast-paced media, where there's lots of choice, it's moving very, very quickly, essentially forces children to repeatedly shift their attention, to renew their orientating responses. So when you do this over and over, over a prolonged period of time, it essentially increases their arousal. Now that high state of arousal, if repeated over many, many times, then becomes the new normal. And once you step away from that, children can then seek to recreate this aroused state, which is where ADHD in part can come in. So think of it this way, as an adult, imagine how you feel when you've been watching a really intense program on TV, or you've been really engrossed on something on your phone or iPad. Once you step away, it can take a second to readjust. Now, for a developing brain, that impact can be made more marked, and especially if it's happening a lot. In fact, Dr. Mona says that for a young child, the period following prolonged screen time can cause a delay in cognitive processing skills. So that means for the immediate period after spending time in front of a screen, they're not really getting the input that you're putting in front of them, and certainly not as clearly as they would have been if there had been no screen. So it's not all about how terrible screens are and making everyone feel bad. Once again, this is about how we use screens in a positive and manageable way, because whether we like it or not, technology is now part of our lives. So, on our recent podcast with Dr. Mona, we actually talked a lot about this, and the link again is on thejourneydot.com. Her view is that ultimately a child needs to be engaged as much as they possibly can outside of a device. Now, it's okay to incorporate if you've had other activities through the day. There is definitely a time that's okay for a screen. Once again, the trouble comes in excess. So when there's more screen time than human interaction, and that does play a part in the child's neurological development, particularly in the first 4 years of life, according to Dr. Mona. Now, what's a healthier way to do it? Well, one thing is to watch something together. So a good example would be watching something, whether it be on TV or an iPad. Ask your child questions about what they're seeing. Make it interactive. Break it up a little bit. Dr. Mona argues that making it a point of learning and a social activity can definitely make it more positive. Now, obviously, for a younger child, say below two, it can be a bit more challenging. But once again, that's another reason that a younger child is best to use sparingly where you can. The next thing is about boundaries. So if you're using screen time for a younger child, once again, using it sparingly is key. Now, setting boundaries and ensuring you're prioritizing more human-to-human interaction is the way to go. So say using screens for 15 minutes a day, perhaps you've got to do the dishes or something else, but that's a good example of setting a boundary. Allowing this time, then enforcing a boundary, is actually pretty positive all around. And when it comes to healthy boundaries, everyone in the family needs to be on board with it and enforce this. So it's no good if you're trying to do something and your partner then goes and overrides. It has to be something that everyone is absolutely on board with. And actually, this can turn into a positive thing. Now, when it comes to older kids and screens, coming back to Christoph's point on age, Dr. Mona completely agrees. The younger a child is, the less they should have. But from 5 years on and upward, Dr. Mona believes when it's used in a controlled way, screens and technology can be used in a positive, healthy and learning-based way. So all in all, it's not really rocket science. It's pretty sensible. Make sure your child has more human and learning interaction. And if you are going to use screens, obviously keep it to a minimum for a younger child. And then as the child gets older, enforcing boundaries, making it as social as possible, and including interaction, and then you can't go too wrong. But once again, for more from Dr. Mona and Christoph, check out thejourneydot.com. Okay, so staying on the subject of brains and their development. Now, we know that issues around neurodevelopment are on the rise. As always, as we keep saying, there is rarely a single reason why issues develop. It's more a combination of factors. So we decided to turn to the latest research to look at some of the positive ways science suggests we can help the development of brains in a little person. Now, We know that the most rapid period of brain development is from conception to around the age of two. So this is the time to do all you can possibly do to help your baby's brain develop as best as it can. Now, what we've done is to dig into a number of sources, but particularly draw on one publication, which is super respected in the field of science, and that's The Lancet. And there's some links if you want to really dig into their research up on thejourney.com. But we're going to try and keep it simple and get into the 15 ways and the practical ways. So let's start with some of the good guys for brain development, starting with DHA. Now, you've probably heard of the power of omega-3s for brain development. It's not really a secret these days, but specifically DHA. The main point is that it's a structural constituent of the central nervous system. So basically, you need enough. Now, is there a time that DHA is particularly powerful? It's obviously something that's important to have throughout your pregnancy because it's a powerful anti-inflammatory, and chronic inflammation is not what you want. However, what we do know is that it starts to build rapidly in a baby during the last trimester and continues at very high rates up to the end of the second year of life. And this can also happen through breastfeeding. Now, how much do you actually need? Now, you can find DHA in oily, fatty fish. Now, obviously, remember to go low down the food chain to reduce your mercury exposure. But research shows that around 1 to 2 portions a week provide a decent amount. Now, if you're going down the supplement route, as always, remember, speak to your doctor first. But the latest research suggests that around 500 to 800 milligrams per day is reasonable. And ideally, once again, you want to look for those supplements that are selling DHA based on wild fish, and obviously those that are low down the food chain. Next up is once again back to our obsession, the gut. Now, the science is pointing to having a healthy gut during pregnancy as really important for brain development. It also suggests that having a solid foundation for a baby in their earliest days will stand them in great stead, particularly when it comes to a developing brain. Now, once again, we have got so much stuff as to how this actually works up on the site, as well as the quick how to approach this. So check out thejourney.com for much more on that. Next up, a bit more surprising, is music and touch. Now, it turns out there's a physical reason why you're unlikely to be able to keep your hands off your little one in the earliest days. Now, most interestingly, research in premature babies has shown real benefit in terms of brain development from the power of touch and closeness. And science is telling us that basically, despite what some theories from a child rearing perspective have been, you cannot spoil a baby with too many cuddles. It's also shown fascinating results when it comes to the power of music. Now, crucially, fMRI scans have shown differences between the crucial networks and connections with the brain from those babies that have had no music exposure to those who have had very regular, and especially benefits for premature babies. It's pretty cool stuff. And again, check out the site for much more on that. Next up is iodine. We're going to be talking about why having enough is crucial for brain development. Now, iodine plays a huge role in thyroid function, and thyroid is obviously a key hormone in the body. Now, the thyroid uses iodine to make T3 and T4, and studies show that both of these begin to rise from mid-pregnancy with a sudden release at birth. Now, it does appear that this hormone plays a role in helping the baby adapt to the outside world, and having enough is crucial to brain development. Now, it's tricky to get enough from food, but if you did want to look at food, see vegetables, cranberries, plain yogurt, strawberries, potatoes, seafood, eggs, green peas, cheese and bananas are good sources. We also obviously have iodine salt. If you are concerned about your levels and your thyroid, and again, we've got much more detail up on the site, signs and symptoms to watch out for if you might have an issue with your thyroid, you should absolutely speak to your doctor. It is important. So again, check out the site for a little bit more on that. Next up, time to invest in a good water filter. Do we really have to worry about our water? Well, it turns out in certain areas there are things in our system that little brains don't want too much of. And as always, we're not talking about small exposures here or there that do harm. It's just making sure we don't get too much and minimize wherever you possibly can. Now, the World Health Organization has identified areas within at least 50 countries where inorganic arsenic, yes, really, is at a level that can potentially be harmful. And that's something to watch out for. The good news is a simple Brita filter can actually reduce the amount by as much as 70%, which is a great start. The second thing to watch out for in your water is fluoride. Now, some areas add it to the water supply, and there is evidence suggests this is not good for a developing brain. Once again, we've got lots more up on the site about it. Now, the good news is it's pretty easy to find out. Your local authority will be able to tell you if it is added to your water supply. And if it is, then obviously having a proper filter to address this is the way to go, especially in the early days. Next up, chlorella. Is this a brain superfood? Now, this grass green algae has actually shown very real and science-based benefit when it comes to helping remove toxins from the body. Interestingly, it's not a supplement and it can be eaten anytime from conception, pregnancy, and even by little babies. In fact, my son actually quite likes to eat it. It's also really high in protein and other phytonutrients, but most crucially, it is a very, very effective chelator. And that means it effectively attaches to some of the toxins that can potentially cause us harm. Worth checking out. And actually, we did a big podcast on this with one of the leading experts. So check out the podcast links for that. Next up, things developing brains should avoid. Now, we all know that you're probably fed up of the scary toxin things in the world. I know I am. And it often feels exhausting and overwhelming having to think about these things. But once again, it's just about breaking it down, and we've distilled from the latest research a couple of things just to keep an eye on. First thing is paracetamol. Now, should we seek an alternative? The research around paracetamol in children's pain medication and even our own continues to grow about the potentially damaging effect during pregnancy and for use in small people post-birth. The reality is that research suggests during pregnancy it's best to avoid completely, and there are new studies emerging all the time about the impact that taking paracetamol can have on a developing brain. Now, once your child is above 3 months old, research suggests that it may be better to use an ibuprofen-based painkiller from the perspective of brain development. Once again, we've got a lot more on the site about this. Don't feel bad if you've used paracetamol for your child. Many of us have. Once again, it's not a one-off that actually makes a difference. Lots of things together, and it's just about reducing your risk where you can. So check out thejourneydot.com for more on that. Next up, manganese. It's all about Goldilocks. Now, as with most things, it's about moderation. Manganese is actually something the body needs in a small amount. We just don't want too much of it. Where can it be found in excess? Well, it can be found in air pollution, water, so once again, reach for your filter, and even baby formula. Now, the good news is things like a HEPA air purifier, if you live near a busy road or in traffic, or not that you live in traffic, but near traffic, are good to have. Water filters, once again, also help. And finally, just check your formula to see the amounts. Now, it is worth bearing in mind that soy formulas tend to have the most. We had a look at all the formulas out there and actually found that HIP Organic had the least. So another reason to have a look at that one. Next up, methylmercury. Definitely an avoid for a developing brain. Now, it's pretty well known by now that too much big fish can cause potential mercury exposure. We've got lots more up on the site, but it's pretty simple. Just avoid too much of it. So limit your fish intake to 2 to 3 times a week and go low down the food chain. The smaller the fish, the better. And this is ideal when you're thinking about conception, pregnancy, breastfeeding, and for small people. Next up is plastics. So it's not just bad for the environment. So plastic, or specifically BPA, which is found in some plastics, is not good for anyone. It's especially not good for brain development. The good news is that baby products are now generally BPA-free. Another simple solution, just use glass, paper bags, and particularly avoid heating up plastic, and especially heating up plastic containers that contain food or drink. We've got a quick, easy guide up on the site for how to know if there's BPA and how to avoid it. Next up, watch to watch for your and your baby's beauty cabinet. And this one's actually really easy. Just simply avoid added fragrance. Why do this? Well, this just minimizes the chance of phthalates being present. And again, we've got a ton more on the site about why these are not things you want exposure to. Toluene is another one. It's commonly found in nail polish and remover. So either go without or just make sure your brand is toluene free. It's pretty easy to find that out. And actually go onto the Environmental Working Group site, type in the name of your brand and it should come up with whether or not you've got toluene present. Then it's back to our old favourites, the pesticides and herbicides. Now, glyphosate or chlorophorus are two specific types where there is compelling evidence showing that there is potential damage, prolonged exposure to a growing brain. Now, obviously going organic wherever possible is helpful, but it's not always possible. Now, we have got three easy ways to avoid too much exposure up on the site. Check out thejourney.com. Next, dry cleaning. Well, actually, there's an ingredient in dry cleaning fluid to really watch out for if you're pregnant. Now, what do you do? Well, simply just reduce exposure where you can and avoid using any dry cleaning on products your baby is directly exposed to. Finally, flame retardants. We know that flame retardants in things like clothing or sofas or any kind of furniture are things to avoid. So just keep an eye on the label when you're buying anything for your baby. Now, the reality is that you probably have some things in your house that do contain them, but actually simply dusting and vacuuming regularly in your home helps keep this dust actually quite well at bay. So, sounds like quite a lot, but we've got the 15 things you need to think about up on the site with lots more detail. So just check out thejourney.com for lots more on that. Okay, so finally for this week's bumper edition, how to avoid a common diet trap for your hormones. Now, these days, it seems to be all about the low carb or the ketogenic diet. Question is, could this inadvertently be pushing our hormones off balance, particularly when it comes to thinking about or trying to have a healthy small person? Now, I will be the first to admit that actually I myself fell victim of this. So I'm definitely speaking for first-hand experience here. Now, the reality is our hormones are pretty delicately balanced. However, sometimes we inadvertently do a pretty good job at making it hard for our bodies to maintain that balance. And in fact, the low-carb or ketogenic diet can be a potential example of this. So obviously the 90s was all about low-fat, and now it's all about low-carb. And whilst different things work for different people, different circumstances and times of their life, when it comes to the process of fertility, conception, pregnancy, it's always being mindful, particularly when it comes to some potentially unintended consequences of cutting out entire food groups. Now, here at The Journey, we're actually really wary of cutting out big food groups, unless, of course, you have a medical reason to do so. And so in this particular case, we're going to have a quick look about what you need to know about the sometimes hidden effect of very low carbs. And again, specifically when it comes to trying to have healthy small people. So there are two main areas that can potentially be impacted by a low carb or ketogenic diet. So the first one is thyroid hormones. Now the thyroid is crucial to pretty much everything in our bodies. It's especially important for fetal development and reproduction and the menstrual cycle. And the trouble is with very low carb diets, it typically means you have very low insulin in your blood. Now, why does this matter? Don't we actually want low insulin? As usual, it's all about Goldilocks, so not too much, not too little. Insulin is really important for transforming the inactive form, which is called T4, to the active form, which is T3. Now, without it, we get problems. Now, the flip side, of course, is that you don't want too much insulin, particularly if you have things like polycystic ovarian syndrome. So what are we saying? This sounds confusing. Now, it seems obvious to say, but it's actually just about moderation. All we're trying to do here is to show the evidence-backed consequences on hormones if you do decide to cut things out completely. And there's sometimes consequences that we may not think of that happen when we follow some of these more extreme diets. and particularly if you're doing it for a prolonged period of time, especially if you're trying to have kids. And the next thing to bear in mind is stress and low carb diets. Now, we talk a lot about how stress is bad, and obviously it's not just the mental side, it's the physical side as well. And there's obviously no prizes for pointing that out. But did you know that too little carbohydrate can cause a physical and hormonal stress response in our bodies when done for a prolonged period of time? Now think about it this way. Our bodies are pretty primordial. If we're not getting enough food, calories, or have physical stress, our hormones react accordingly. Basically, your body thinks you're in famine, which is obviously what used to happen many, many years ago. So usually what happens is the body produces hormones that are designed to protect us and promote survival. It's pretty smart if you think about it. Now you may have heard of these hormones before, particularly in our chronically stressed modern lives. So we're talking about cortisol and norepinephrine. Now when these hormones are released in large amounts or over a long period of time, your body essentially goes into survival mode. And that means the body is not going to be prioritized bringing a small human into the situation, which is actually fair enough. So the trouble is, with very low carbs, it does signal a potential threat to the body, and the body will react and will produce more of these stress hormones. And in fact, research has shown evidence that when this happens over a long period of time, it can have a real impact on our menstrual cycle. And this can be known as HPA axis dysfunction. Now, we've got lots and lots of ways how you can tackle stress. So looking at exercise, to ashwagandha, to even practical tips for mind health and meditation. But the bottom line is, it's actually really not rocket science. And although it sounds obvious, hopefully this makes the point that actually just eating a balanced diet is really the way to go. I know it's tempting that sometimes when we're faced with these new diets that promise the earth, it's easy to overlook that you could have unintended consequences. But it's even more important to help the body stay in balance when you're trying to get pregnant, or you are pregnant, or you have a small person. So how do you approach carbs really for our purposes? Now, all this being said, we're also not advocating a high carb diet either. Once again, it's about Goldilocks, because high carbs and too much sugar can play havoc, particularly if you have things like polycystic ovarian syndrome that I have, because about 70% of people have insulin resistance that have PCOS. Now, the first and foremost, most important thing, as always, to do, if you have any medical complication, you always speak to your doctor. But for everyone else, a more sensible recommendation is to eat between 15 and 30% of your diet from carbs. But the most important thing to remember is that not all carbs are created equally. And this is where we get into the more interesting part. Now, it's being increasingly recognized that white, refined, and processed carbohydrates will do nothing but push your body further out of balance, not to mention spike your blood sugar, put it all over the place, and that's certainly not what you want, especially if you're just trying to get your body into balance, which is what we want. Now, on the flip side, a moderate amount of whole, low glycemic index carbs, so think brown rice, sweet potato, whole grain fresh bread, oats, quinoa, are definitely the way to go. Balance, you may have noticed, is the buzzword of this message here. Balance with a mix of protein and fat to help you keep full and keep that all-important blood sugar stabilized is really what you need to be doing. So again, if you want to have a look at any more of the info, it's up on the site, www.thejourney.com. And we hope to speak to you next week.